And welcome back. This is Stephen Buck, President and CEO of Care Providers Oklahoma, and this is another episode of Studio CPO. We thank you for listening to our podcast series, and we really appreciate it when you take a moment to share these podcasts. Thrilled this week to have as my guest a good friend, somebody I've worked with for a number of years, and a outstanding citizen of a Southwest Oklahoma community. So we have to stick together in that regard. Representative Marcus McIntyre. Marcus, thank you for spending a few minutes with me today.
Happy to be here, Steve. Happy.
And, you know, you have always been characteristically an upbeat, optimistic person. I know that your exuberance shows for itself, but there'll be many in our audience who have never met you. They've just heard about you. Give a glimpse of who Marcus McIntyre is and what brought you to the State House of Representatives.
Well, so I'm an entrepreneur. My wife and I own a couple of businesses. I'm an insurance agent. We also own distinctivedecor.com, where we sell fine things for the table and home. And my wife started that in our basement. I run businesses and try to keep them profitable as much as I can while trying to do this job. But I am I didn't realize how optimistic I was until I became a legislator. And because there's a kind of a sine wave that happens with policy here. And you think you're going to get it done, and then it falls apart. You think you're going to get it done, and it falls apart again. And when you finally get it done and it finally congeals, all that optimism was worth it. But I think that maybe optimism is somewhat of a defense mechanism too.
Sure.
That I have kind of appropriated, you know, over my tenure here, because working on policy, especially complex policy, it tends to be a little bit controversial, not at the public scene, but within this building. So I think that the optimism probably is a defense mechanism, but I think I also am very optimistic about things in general, that they end up working out in the end. As long as I put forth my best effort, I probably can.
Now, were you naturally inclined to get into politics, or the decision to run, was that prompted by desire to impact huge changes? What brought you to the legislative arena?
I think, you know, to be really honest, you know, I got to the point where I was getting bored with what I was doing. I wanted a new challenge, but also I kept seeing that the state had, I think at that time, had a $700 million budget shortfall. And I'm like, why can't these jokers fix this budget? I mean, I can fix a budget really quickly in my businesses. I know how to do it. And so that was kind of the kind of poke in the side to get me to run. I'd always thought I would do it at some point. I thought I would be good at it with my personality and sales skills. And this job is sales. It really is. And people like to do business with people they like. And so if you have an attitude, a friendly attitude, you have integrity, people trust you, and then you get down and you have some competence and people see, oh my gosh, he actually understands healthcare policy. That's crazy. It really set me up to be successful in this building. And I think my wife asked the other day, she asked my LA, how many bills I'd had signed by the governor in 8 years. I was shocked. At 121.
That's an incredible record.
It's like 15 bills a session. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so I've been blessed, but I think a lot of it is just people's trust in me and the hard work that I put in this job. And let me tell you, my hair is a lot grayer since I've been in office, but it's been worth every minute. I love the institution and I will miss it.
So I want to come back to the fact that you ended that sentence with, I will miss it. But before we get to the miss it part, healthcare. I mean, you are generally recognized, I would think, of the 149 men and women who are elected to our state house or state senate. Your name is always at the top of having an understanding and mastery of the healthcare environment. you mentioned insurance. Was it your insurance background, or was it paying attention to what was happening in Duncan and understanding how important it was that we get healthcare right?
It was definitely locally generated, my interest in healthcare, because I was serving on the Duncan Health Hospital Foundation Board.
With Jay Johnson, right? Working with Jay. Yeah,
but I mean, we weren't doing anything policy. We were raising money for the foundation to use to buy spare medical equipment and things like that. But he would come in and talk about Medicaid reimbursement rates or you know, how they lost money on them. And so I just asked questions. Why? How can this happen? And that was the part that kind of got, I don't know, it was just a beckoning for me to learn more. And so I just started researching on my own. And then when I realized I was actually going to run, I started thinking, where can I niche? Where can I niche here and make myself, because that's what I do in business, find a niche. I mean, in my insurance business, we insure a ton of nonprofits. That's my niche. Mm-hmm. And so I had to find a niche here. And usually it finds you. And I just think because of my relationship with my hospital CEO and my local hospital, that it just kind of pushed me in this direction. And I think reading contracts, insurance contracts and things like that make you really good at being able to read a bill and deciding what a bill does. So I think all of that kind of came together, and then just an overall interest in healthcare. I just blossomed.
Well, I would be remiss on behalf of the association, the members that I serve, if I didn't thank you for your passionate advocacy on healthcare. And it has been a broad-based and a far-reaching healthcare advocacy. You've dealt with managed care for our populations that are part of the Medicaid expansion population. You've worked in the space of health information exchange, pharmaceutical pricing. You have been at the center of a lot of very complex arguments. So thank you for always having that voice.
Well, let me at least give everybody a dose of humility here, because I could not have done any of those things without smart people on the outside directing me and counseling me. I mean, people like you and I have been working together since I got here. Mm-hmm. And we became friends early on because you're a trustworthy dude. And
I'm going to repeat that to my wife. I'm going to take that one snippet. Okay. You're a trustworthy dude.
You are. Okay. And so part of being in this job is having the ability to discern and being able to discern who's real, who's not, what they're telling you is true or not. Okay. And so that's just something that you've got a good gut for, you don't.
Right. So a minute ago, you used the term, you will miss it. And you have talked publicly that you will not be filing for reelection. You're going to move on to the next phase of your life, whatever that may look like. Having that perspective in the middle of legislative session gives you and you have never been one to be shy about expressing your opinion,
no.
But it is amplified a little bit more at the moment that your name will not be on the ballot in June when we have primaries, nor will it be on the ballot in November with generals. So with that lens, kind of give me your commentary about where you see the dynamics in Oklahoma politics currently. And you don't have to go off on any particular individual or anything like that. It's just, this is a challenging process we're in the midst of.
So, I mean, you have a vast supermajority of Republicans, and there's really, you have some moderate members like me. I don't mind being called a moderate. I don't mind being called a rhino. But you don't, so if your caucus gets as big as it is, as ours is, I don't remember how many members we have now, 81 maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, what ends up happening is you don't have enough Democrats in the House to pull any policy more toward the middle. They have no power to do so. So you're really depending on moderates within your own caucus, which is a really risky place to be. It's a risky position. And so, you know, I, as I see it go forward, I just think you're going to continue to have a vast majority of Republicans with little constraint on the policies, and sometimes our worst side comes out in some of those policies. So I think you'll see more of that. I hope with the new leadership team that's coming in, they don't have a lot of political ambition to move up or anything like that. And I hope you'll see a much saner House, less hopefully a little less partisan than it has been. Mm-hmm. But I don't see how it could not be partisan with Republicans having a supermajority. It's just, you know, it's not that I want Republicans to lose control or anything like that. It's just balance usually makes for better policy. And so we'll still be unbalanced. The policy is still going to be all right, either leaning or heavily right in its focus. And so that's where I see things keeping on going. Mm-hmm. But that's why we have to have good people come up here and advocate, because there are positions being advocated for out here that Republicans just don't think about, or they have no experience in, or something like that. So that's kind of, I hope that's a vague answer, but I see more of the same. Mm-hmm. And people, the Republican Party really wants us to punish their enemies. And that's really problematic.
So one thing that you said, you talked about your own local roots in terms of what informed you, how you became a healthcare expert, is you were informed very heavily by local constituents. And having you give that diagnosis, your overview of the environment, one thing that always comes to mind that I think we as voters get lazy about is we forget the adage that all politics is local. And I would assume, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I would be interested in your response to this. Your trajectory in this body was heavily determined by people at the local level who cared to get engaged with you early in the process, to make sure you were informed, to make sure that you were always up to speed with what was happening at the ground level. So is it fair to say that as we think about what the House and the Senate might look like in 2025 and beyond, that it's still that local relationship at your local Kiwanis Club, at your local community of worship, at your local T-ball game, that's where it really should be happening, right?
Absolutely. And I think it does happen there if you're out among the people of your district, if you're out doing those things. If you're not, you can get caught in an echo chamber really quickly up here. Mm-hmm. It's always nice to go home, because when you go home, you get to be objective again, and you're like, okay, this is not as big of a deal out here as it is inside that building. So yeah, it's all grassroots. I mean, my politics are pretty risky for a Republican, and you know, House District 50 has stuck with me because I think they like my cool head, and I try to be calm. I try to be a peacemaker instead of sowing discord, and we need more of that in politics and less of the polemics that we see.
So for our listeners, Marcus was instrumental in 2019 with Senate Bill 280, which was a fundamental shift in long-term care, yes, nursing care in the state. And I give you that intro for this follow-up discussion, which is going to be, clearly you became invested emotionally and intellectually in our sector, serving, yes, seniors early in your legislative tenure. So you would have a greater knowledge base than the majority of your colleagues. So it was with that context that you got to see our sector serve as ground zero during the COVID pandemic. Mm-hmm. You got to see it. You got to see it as an appropriator, but you also got to see it about somebody who had taken the time to understand what was happening.
But that was all local too. I mean, I had the Wilkins, and I had Jeff Gregston, and all these folks talking to me as well. So yep, they battered me up real well to come up here and be at least knowledgeable, somewhat knowledgeable on their issues.
Right. So as you think about that, and again, that speaks to the fact of members, take your time to get to know your officials, not only after they're elected, but while they're seeking your vote. They're probably never more receptive when they're out knocking doors seeking votes.
And I know that I hate to say this, and I say it all the time, money is the great elixir here. And I mean, if you give them a $250 or $500 you know, donation or contribution, you got their ear.
Right.
You do. Yep. You have it.
So with that background, I want to give some props to the men and women who are serving every day to serve our seniors. Mm-hmm. With Senate Bill 280, you saw the pandemic, you know some of the unique challenges. When you think about the future of long-term care, as somebody who is currently an appropriator, won't be wearing that hat in 6 to 8 more weeks, What lessons have you learned as you've watched this, and now you've watched Senate Bill 280 unfold, about serving seniors, especially those who may need Medicaid? What are some of the take-homes that have resonated with you?
It should be a non-negotiable for the state, first of all. We should take care of the people who need it the most. And so that's why I've tried to fund you guys as much as I possibly can. I know that you're underpaid according to your cost reports. And all that. So we've been trying to slowly. You can't just hit a grand slam the first year. The budget chairman aren't going to put that type of right. money out there. But as long as we can see that that money is being used and being used well, we will give more. And we know as legislators that nursing homes in Oklahoma are underfunded on the Medicaid side, probably on the Medicare side too. But we can't control that. But on the Medicaid side, we have to do our best to make sure that we're funneling the money to the appropriate places. And if there's not any more appropriate place than nursing homes. Right. I mean, people are doing the Lord's work, taking care of people who are likely going to die pretty quick. I know that most of your members probably like, they're moving us to value, or they want to move us to value-based purchasing and all of this, and where's the value? There are some things there, and we're gonna have to operate within that new paradigm of value. We can't go back. I mean, fortunately, you're protected right now. The ABD population is still being protected in fee for service, but the landscape is going to move to value. And I think value is a hoax, personally. But that's where it's going to go. Any way the federal government can get, or even the state government, to have some budget certainty and put risk on a carrier, they're going to do that. And so your people need to be ready for that. Mm-hmm. All you nursing homeowners, you need to be ready and thinking about value. You need to talk to Steve Buck and people at your association. If you have ideas, hey, this is a metric where we know that we can move some stats on that, and we can make it better. And so I think that if everybody has the attitude is, look, we don't just want to be nursing home administrators and owners. We want to do it better than everybody else. Right. And the government's going to incentivize you to do it 5% better. They're going to incentivize you to do it 10% better. And so just know that this is coming, and you're not going to like it. You're going to kick and scream. But this is where we're going. Right. And so I think to be realistic about that, and so if you have ideas for key metrics that you want to see put in statute, like we started with body weight and
pressure ulcers, UTIs, and antipsychotic use.
Yes. And so we started with those four. And you know what? All your members, I mean, I can remember some members calling me saying, hey, we finally did it.
We
got better, and now we're getting paid more.
Yeah.
And so now the thing is to try to build on that, to show the healthcare authority that, hey, we're being good stewards of people's money, and we're taking good care of people. I know you got a lot of challenges around that, but staffing, costs, I know all of that. It seems insurmountable.
Well, but what I would share, and I speak to my members about this a lot, Marcus, which is we owe it to the taxpayer to be transparent.
Yes.
To be very candid where we struggle. We were struggling in antipsychotics. We were struggling in pressure ulcers. That's why we were incentivized to be better.
Yeah.
But also, we need to be transparent and celebrate the things that we do well.
Yes.
And I would share with you, I don't know if I've ever said this, my father passed away in a nursing home during the middle of COVID. And the facility that cared for him allowed my father to exit this earthly existence with dignity, respect, and compassion.
Yeah, my grandmother did as well, just not too long ago.
And we have men and women across the country who show up every single day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, who are there doing that work. And I always want to remember to celebrate them. And that's important. So I'm going to transition to a couple of closing questions now. And this is where you have more of a free field.
It won't limit it to 25 minutes if you let me talk on.
Oh, no, you go as long as you want to. Okay. So the first question, I mean, I have no doubt that there have been days that you've shown up to work, whether it's here at the Capitol or whether it was in your private enterprises, and it was a sticky situation. Things weren't going well. You were facing insurmountable odds. So for the portion of our conversation that I really focus on leadership development, what has been an axiom of leadership, a trusted, tried and true that you could consider a bedrock principle for Marcus McIntyre, that when things got challenging, you would lean into a specific leadership tenet or belief?
I think first of all, it's integrity. Yeah. If people don't trust you, you're not going to do anything in this building. And so I think actively guarding one's integrity up here is super, super important. And, you know, there's also some charisma that you have, mm-hmm. and you've got to be able to recognize how much you have. And I'm fairly good at that self-assessment and when to use it. I think it's just your track record. My track record has been so good here that people really trust me on these issues, and I haven't had to really lean into anything other than being a highly competent human being, mm-hmm. Who understands the politics, who can work within that the political constraints that you have. I just think it's being keenly self-aware and then how people are viewing you. And it's kind of an intangible that some people have and some people sure. really have to develop. For some reason, I have a really good BS meter, and it's hard to BS a BSer. Yep. And so, but I think it's being consistent, being honest, being friendly. I mean, it's not hard to say hi to somebody you disagree with,
right.
and how your kids, how's your wife.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, connecting on a human level and then letting your work, you know, precede you. And letting your integrity precede you. And that's really what I've relied on this whole time.
All right. We're going to move to our final question. So you've had a very accomplished career in this body. You've had a successful career as an entrepreneur. There is a new horizon that's going to be before you for whatever that turns out to be as you step away from elected office, at least this elected office. Marcus, what do you know now that you wish that 21-year-old Marcus had known when you started your career trajectory?
Oh, my gosh. I think coming to the realization that nothing is easy.
Okay.
Nothing. Nothing is easy, and nothing worth doing is easy. It's mm-hmm. all hard. And but I've learned over the years, I didn't know how to trick myself. Into, you know, usually you see this big Herculean task in front of you and you might wilt because you're like, oh, this is going to be so much work, so okay. much time, so much effort. And, but you just can't let that stop you. And you have to convince yourself. I tell myself this, you guys are going to think I'm nuts. But when I have something really hard to do, I say, this is going to be easy. This mm-hmm. is going to be easy. I'm going to be able to do this. This is going to be easy. And I convince myself that it's not hard, and it sure makes it a lot easier. And then I bring in a ton of people to consult with me and to help guide me. And I'll throw my ideas off them. They throw their ideas off me. And it's a collaborative process.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm going to kind of deviate here because you asked what I will miss about this place.
Yeah.
I'm going to miss the relationships.
Yeah.
I'm going to miss the people. I'm going to miss the pace. I always love it during Christmas time at our store, Distinctive Decor, because it is so fast paced. And I love that. I thrive in an environment that way. And it doesn't stress me out. I actually get energy from it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can only do that for so long, though.
Yeah.
And so I'm to the point in my career where I just don't have as much tolerance for it as I used to. And so that tells me it's probably time for me to get out.
Mm-hmm. Well, as someone who, in your case, your life for the last several years has been dictated by ringing bells and sergeant yelling house roll call, mm-hmm. that will be soon substituted with your wife saying, hey, you got to mow the yard. Yeah. You know, it's going to be a different rhythm, but it'll still be there.
The greatest quote from my wife and probably the most jarring to me is she said, you know, you are really good at fixing other people's problems. Why don't you come home and fix some of ours? Well, that's it in a nutshell.
Yep.
and she's ready for me to be home. I'm ready to be home with her.
Yeah.
Missed a lot of my kids' activities and stuff like that. I've got two seniors now mm-hmm. that are going to graduate this year. And it is time to simplify our lives. Yep. And fortunately, we have the ability to do that.
Well, you've been a delightful guest. Let me again acknowledge, thank you for your service to the state. Thank you for your service to the district. And thank you for your friendship. I've always enjoyed connecting with you in this rhythm. And we'll soon find a new rhythm with which to continue our friendship.
Well, let's... that will always be the case. Yep. We'll always be friends. And this year, hopefully, we can get the money that nursing homes need to get them up to at least a break-even point, yep. at least.
Yep.
And I will be urging Chairman Thank Wallace to give the full amount. We have the money. And if anybody tells you we don't have the money, they're not telling you the truth. We just have to move some stuff around, and this can be done. And so don't lose hope.
Thank you, sir. Yeah. We appreciate you. This is Stephen Buck signing off for Studio CBO.